You know, mistakes are inevitable in the publishing business. And I saw this advertisement reportedly appear in the daily newspaper. It said, Monday, the Reverend A.J. Jones is one color TV set for sale. Telephone 626-1313 after 7 p.m. Ask for Mrs. Donnelly, who lives with him, cheap. Tuesday, we regret any embarrassment caused to Reverend Jones by a typographical error in yesterday's paper. The ad should have read, the Reverend A.J. Jones has one color TV set for sale, cheap. Telephone 626-1313 and ask for Mrs. Donnelly, who lives with him after 7 p.m. Wednesday, the Reverend A.J. Jones informs us that he has received several annoying telephone calls because of an incorrect ad in yesterday's paper. It should have read, the Reverend A.J. Jones has one color TV set for sale, cheap. Telephone 626-1313 after 7 p.m. and ask for Mrs. Donnelly, who loves with him. Thursday, please take notice that I, the Reverend A.J. Jones, have no color TV set for sale. I have smashed it. Don't call 626-1313 anymore. I have not been carrying on with Mrs. Donnelly. She was until yesterday my housekeeper. Friday, wanted a housekeeper. Usual housekeeping duties, good pay, love in, Reverend A.J. Jones, telephone 626-1313. They're just not going to get it right. Mistakes are inevitable in the publishing business, but let's face it, mistakes are inevitable in our lives. Mistakes, they can be costly, they can even be well-intentioned. Mistakes, some are covered up and some are made worse by our poor decisions to fix them. Mistakes, we have all made them. It has been said, if at first you don't succeed, you're running about average. That is true. Where do we go with our mistakes? And do mistakes have to be fatal? We began a new sermon series last week on the life of Moses entitled Through It All. That through all seasons and stages of life, we see a God who is taking us somewhere. Well, today, we will look at a tragic mistake made by this man of faith, Moses. And we will see that through it all, God is preparing his man for his purposes. Well, as we look at the life of Moses, we discover he is a man like us, right? Faults and vulnerabilities and failures. And what will be obvious as we travel with Moses this summer is the frequency in which we found himself at some crossroad where he must decide which way to turn. You see, because into every life are crossroads. Webster defines a crossroad as a crucial point, especially where a decision must be made. Are you at a crossroad? Some we prepare for, but most often they come to our lives unexpectedly. Well, today we come to the crossroad of failure. Of failure. Well, if you're not there, turn with me in your Bibles to the second book of the Bible, the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus. And you will recall that in our continuing story of Israel, as we continue from the book of Genesis, Israelites are in Egypt. They are under a great oppression by Egyptian slave masters who are submitting to a paranoid, insecure king who is threatened by the growing number of Israelites in his land. And with irrational rage, he ordered all Israelite baby boys to be thrown into the Nile River. Baby Moses, whose name means draw out, is rescued by the king's own daughter. Now, to this point, Moses' life was the product of a series of choices made by others. That's about to change. We left off in chapter 2, verse 10. I hope your eyes are there. Verse 10 of chapter 2 with these words. When the child, meaning Moses, grew older, she, Jochebed, which is Moses' mom, took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. Moses goes from being drawn out of the water to being in hot water to being a waterer. Well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Let's look at this passage here, these 15 verses, chapter 2, verses 11 through 25. And my approach to these verses is to break it down into scenes. So scene 1 is a life-changing decision, a life-changing decision. So look at me at verse 11 of chapter 2. One day after Moses had grown up. Now, I need to give you some context here. Between verse 10 and verse 11 is about 40 years. 40 years. We know that because in Acts chapter 7 and Stephen's sermon, he references this time in Moses' life and that he was approaching 40 years old. Well, what has Moses been up to for the past 40 years? Well, we left off last week with Moses, his mother, nurturing her son for a season before letting him go to the daughter of Pharaoh. You see, Moses was raised in royalty. He had all the benefits of the royal life, a great education, luxuries of the palace, finest of foods, and he would not be denied any pleasures. He would have attended the Oxford of the ancient world. He would have immersed himself in the arts of sculpture and music and painting. And again, collecting some information about these verses, we looked at Stephen's sermon in Acts 7. Acts 7, verse 22 informs us that Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. That's just another way of saying he was brilliant. He was brilliant. He had made a name for himself, and as the son of the princess, he wielded both power and influence. It's likely even that he was leading the Egyptian army and knew the combat tactics, and he studied the battles of the nation's proud history. You see, Moses was one highly competent, influential, powerful leader who was greatly respected by the Egyptians. That is not incidental information because of what comes next in verse 11. Following the words, one day after Moses had grown up, we come to what would be life-changing decision. It says, he went out. He went out. Underline that in your minds. He went out to where his own people were, and he watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Now, most often in reading this section or hearing a sermon on this passage, we jump right to the scene of the Egyptian beating the Hebrew, and we'll get there. But we can't pass over these words too quickly. First, notice that in verse 11, it says, his own people, two times. His own people. That's significant, especially if we keep in mind what has been happening, as we just talked about, in Moses' life for the past 40 years. You see, one aspect of Pharaoh's educational system that Moses grew up in and would be brainwashed in was to reinforce the pride of those in power and to show utter contempt for slaves. They taught that slaves were nothing more than the living dead. They compared us slaves to donkeys. After reviewing the ancient Egyptian curriculum, Goren Larson says this. He says, among these documents, one category of educational materials that's particularly conspicuous, namely texts that express a deep contempt of manual labor while stressing the value of study. Studies lead to a life far away from dust, dirt, and toil under harsh taskmasters. This is what Moses grew up in his whole life, to be prejudiced against the slaves and to kind of beef himself up, and that he was a man who studies. It'd be challenging to not have bought into that culture, that thinking. Remember, Moses is writing these words here in Exodus chapter 2, verse 11. He's writing this down, and he refers to these Israelites, these Hebrews, as what? His own people. His own people. Moses, by saying that? He's identifying with them. He sees himself as one of them. He felt a sense of solidarity with them. It could be likened, I suppose, to the famous anti-communist speech by John F. Kennedy, delivered against the backdrop of the Berlin Wall. And Kennedy, in showing the support of the United States for West Germany, said the famous words, "Ich bin ein Berliner." Ich bin ein Berliner. That was the purpose he's saying that was to show his solidarity with the people of Berlin. Now, contrary to urban legend that says he actually said, "I am a jelly donut," that's not really true. Okay, it's a good story, but it's not really true. Kennedy was saying by those words, "I am one of you. I am one of you." See, identifying with the people that we are trying to reach is absolutely critical, church. If we're going to reach the community for Christ, if we're going to reach the region around us, we need to identify with them. Moses identifies with the people. He sympathizes with these slaves, his own people. Secondly, notice the words, he went out to where his own people were. Now, when it says here that Moses went out to where his own people were, his going out would be a life-changing trip. He was a Hebrew at heart, and he took his heart with him as he visited his people. Now, this is where the New Testament book of Hebrews brings all of this into sharper focus for us. And you can look at it later, but the verses are going to show up on your screen here. In Hebrews 11, commonly known as the Hall of Faith chapter, it says in verses 24 and 25, it says, "By faith Moses, when he had grown up," same language here, "refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time." He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God. When did Moses choose this? Right here, Exodus chapter 2, verse 11, when it says he went out to where his own people were. He went out. He was making a choice there. See, he grew up in everything the world had to offer. He went out from that. And at that moment, he was choosing to be mistreated among the Hebrews rather than a privileged Egyptian prince. And by identifying himself with the Israelites, he had everything to lose and nothing to gain from a worldly perspective. But Moses' career advancement was God-centered. He was moved to compassion by the suffering of God's people, his flesh and blood. So he made his choice. He went out. And once he went out, there would be no turning back. He was at that moment, he was signing up for God's assignment. He would be God's man to deliver his people out of slavery and bondage in Egypt. And he could not be that deliverer until he chose to burn all the bridges between himself and the riches and power of the Egyptian court. Moses went out. I ask you, how is that true for you right now? If you made that kind of decision for God, you went out. You signing on for what God wants you to do, and it means turning your back on some other things. You are going out. Have you signed on for him? What is God calling you out of in order to be his man, his woman, his young person, to deliver maybe someone from their bondage of sin? Well, Moses was the right man for the job. However, he had some lessons to learn. Scene 2, wrong solution to a real problem. Wrong solution to a real problem. Moses was so bothered by what his own people were going through, while he lived in the comfort and luxuries of palace life, he had to do something about it. So he went out to where they were, watched them being treated ruthlessly. It was then that he saw this Egyptian beating a Hebrew. Look at verse 12. It says, "Glancing this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand." Now again, this wasn't that Moses was just walking along one day and he happened to see this go on and it bugged him. He became enraged and he killed the man. That's not what's going on here. I believe this was already building up inside. It seems to me that somewhere along the way, the thought of intervening in this way occurred to him, and he might have had this thought often. This is more premeditated than what we might think at first pass. Moses looks to the right. He looks to the left. which is either suggesting he's looking around to see if anyone else is going to step up and do something, or he was looking around to see if anyone would see him do what he was about to do in killing the Egyptian. Either way, as he looked to the right, he looked to the left. There was one direction he forgot to look. He forgot to look up. See, often the difference between doing the right thing and the wrong thing is the direction we're looking. You're faced with a choice right now, and you've looked this way for the advice of everyone around you who might agree with you, or maybe you've looked that way, what others might think about your decision, but you haven't looked up to check in with what God thinks. Again, I want to consider Stephen's take on this killing of the Egyptian in his sermon in Acts 7. It sheds more light on what's going on in Moses' mind. Acts chapter 7, verse 25, says, Moses thought that his own people would realize that God was using him to rescue them, but they did not. I believe Moses knew he was to be the one at this point whom God would use to rescue his people. But what is Moses' plan here? Is he going to wipe out a couple of million of people one at a time? Was he going to do this single-handedly? Or was he hoping that this killing of this Egyptian might rally the troops? Moses was ready to be their deliverer, their redeemer. Now, I want to just spend just a moment here about what is admirable in Moses. He had a hatred for injustice. He was opposed to slavery and this cruel oppression on humanity. He had a loyalty and deep love for God's people. He's certainly passionate. He sympathized with those who suffered. He had a holy zeal. He was willing to jeopardize his Egyptian status and career advancement to identify with the suffering of his own people. We might even say that his heart was in the right place. See, his problem here wasn't one of motivation or even sincerity. It was a problem of method, timing, and taking matters into his own hands. Have you done that? And you've messed up? Years ago, Chicago Cubs relief pitcher Bob Patterson described one of his pitches that he threw to the Reds batter who hit it for a game-winning home run. So this pitcher is describing that one pitch after the game, and he says, well, it was a cross between a screwball and a changeup. It was a screw-up. Do you know any screw-ups? I mean, it kind of describes life sometimes, doesn't it? I mean, maybe even with best intentions, and you've gone totally about it the wrong way. See, watch out, church, for the wrong solution to a real problem. Maybe perhaps of late you're having some problems in your marriage, and so you say, well, I need to do something about these problems in our marriage. Well, listen, don't make matters worse by applying wrong solutions to your real problem. Wrong solutions like manipulation or scheming or trying to change your spouse, that doesn't work. Or looking for unhealthy outlets to meet your needs. Maybe, perhaps, you're here today and you believe it's God's will for you to marry and that you don't believe he's called you to remain single. And here you are. Here's your problem. You're single. So you figure you might help God out a little bit and you're going to just settle for a relationship with someone who isn't on the same page with you spiritually. And it's an unhealthy relationship. Maybe it's a lousy relationship. But it's a wrong solution to a real problem. What real problem confronts you right now? Maybe it's a financial problem. Maybe it's a relational problem. I don't know. Are you tempted to solve it in a way that is outside of the will of God? Moses has a real problem. His people are being oppressed, serving as slaves in a foreign land. That's a real problem. He takes matters into his own hands. Now he has another problem on his hands. A big problem. A dead body. Scene 3. Trying to bury the consequences. Trying to bury the consequences. Moses kills the Egyptian, and he tries to bury his problem, literally. He buries him in the sand. He calls it a night, kind of goes, no harm. I'll just, out of sight, out of mind, I'll just move on. Well, the next day, he returns to the crime scene. It says in verse 13, whether it's the crime scene, I don't know, but it certainly comes back to the picture. And he says in verse 13, the next day, he went out, and this time he saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, I'm not sure how he knew which one was in the wrong that quickly, but he asked the one in the wrong, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? Now, again, Moses doesn't lack passion. He wasn't short in confidence. He was a man of action. He steps in and he breaks up a fight. This time it's between two Hebrews. So he asks, you know, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? And look at verse 14. The man answers, who died and left you, boss? I mean, that's my loose translation. His exact words were, though, who made you ruler and judge over us? Same thing. I mean, and that had to hurt. One of his own people is questioning him. See, others may not understand our well-intentioned mistakes. Well, it gets worse. He then says, the same guy responds, says, are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian? Rescue Operation Moses style isn't going very well. The song, I Did It My Way, is starting to make him nauseous. Moses shaking in his boots, for it occurs to him that the word is out. And Moses' thought, end of verse 14, what I did must have become known. And as I often do, I ask the question, well, how did it become known? Did Moses do such a poor job of burying him in the sand that his toes were sticking out? I don't know. How did it become known? Well, the way I see it is that the only person who knew what Moses had done was the man Moses rescued. In essence, he tattled on him. Now, how frustrating is this? You try and help someone, and they turn on you. You step in, you think you're doing a good job, and you're doing a good thing, and they push you away. I mean, do you know what rejection feels like? I mean, here's rejection. Instead of this man thanking Moses for saving his life, he goes and spreads the word that this Egyptian ruler and official took the life of a fellow Egyptian. See, this is not going according to plan, Moses' plan. He figured as he was coming back to the scene after what he did, he'd be applauded for what he did. They'd embrace him as their rescuer. But they weren't ready for him. They rejected him. And verse 15 says, when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. Now, let's just hit the pause button for a moment for application. Is there a mistake, a wrong, a sin that you're burying, hoping no one will find out? Have you blown it? Do you stand at the crossroad of failure, a mistake, a wrong, a sinful act? I mean, you can try and cover it up. You can dig in and refuse to admit the wrong. What are we to do with our failures? What should we do after we have done it our way? Well, after a flop, stop. Don't make matters worse. Don't just charge ahead. Just kind of pause for a moment. Call it what it is. Own your mistake, your sinful act. Then you'll be in a better position to accept the consequences. Listen, here's the principle. Here's the principle. We are free to choose our actions, but we are not free to choose the consequences of our actions. I mean, let that sink in. We try to manage consequences all the time. No, you can't. Do the right thing for those consequences, yes, but you can't manage them. We are free to choose our actions, but we're not free to choose the consequences of our actions. And so the secret is out. Moses has committed treason. He was siding with the slaves. One writer aptly observed that acting to defend the Hebrews, Moses was challenging the basic foundation, social, political, and religious, on which Egyptian society had been established. It should come as no surprise that Pharaoh would seek to crush him. What a blow to Moses. His own people have rejected him. He's now a wanted man, a fugitive, and he is running for his life. And the end of verse 15 says, Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian. Did you catch that? Live in Midian. This is no vacation for Moses. He didn't travel to Midian on some air-conditioned bus. He wasn't staying at the Marriott of Midian. He's not. He went to live in Midian. He's trying to get away from it. You see, the road that led Moses from the palace to the wilderness was paved with good intentions. He went from the privileges of palace life to the obscurity of fugitive in the wilderness. And for the next 40 years, Midian was Moses' address. 40 years. 40 years of insignificance, 40 years of walking this deserted land. All this because of one bad choice, one mistake. But you can't bury the consequences. Now, if we were reading this for the very first time, and we didn't know the rest of the story, we might wonder if Moses' life would end in obscurity. It was Winston Churchill, in the midst of Nazi bombings, who said to the people of London, "This is not the end, it is not even the beginning of the end, but it's perhaps the end of the beginning." Do you stand at the crossroad of failure right now in your life? If you think you're finished because of one choice, think again. If you think that one mistake, that's the end, that you can't do anything about it, God says, no, you're just getting started. Press on. Now, what's the first thing Moses does when he arrives in Midian? Well, verse 15 tells us that he sat down by a well. Here's scene 4. In failure, be ready for the next task. In failure, be ready for the next task. Moses is sitting by a well. Is he sitting there totally dejected? Is he sitting there reflecting on his life? Is he even questioning God's call in his life? Is he at this place at the well saying, "I give up. I am done"? We don't know what was going through his mind as he sat down by a well through the season of failure, but God is not through with him. He puts an opportunity in front of him that reveals something of the heart of the man of Moses. I pick it up, verse 16. Follow along. Now, a priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up, came to their rescue, and watered their flock. Moses goes from being drawn out of the water to being in hot water to being a waterer. What's going on here? Well, on a typical day, the women would arrive at the well. They would draw water, and they would fill the troughs with water. They would try and get there early enough, because this was a reoccurring problem for them. They knew that these shepherds would bully their way ahead of them. It's even likely that the shepherds waited until the women did all the hard work of filling the troughs before they showed up. Then they would cut in line, and the women would have to wait until the shepherds were done before getting any water, if there was any water left. Now, one thing we can say about Moses is that he can't stand around and do nothing when he sees an injustice. He isn't about to let a bunch of bullies take advantage of these women. But perhaps Moses started to learn something about his previous mistake. He doesn't kill the shepherds. But this is the third time he intervenes where there's an injustice, and at least this time, it's appreciated. The women return home earlier than usual, our passage says, and their father asks about their early arrival. It's a surprise to him that they're already home, and these women tell him what happened. Verse 19, they said, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." Now the father, Reuel, who also we'll see later goes by the name Jethro, Reuel wants to know, the dad here wants to know, who is this man who saved his 7 daughters? Who is this man who defended the innocent and stood against injustice? And I think maybe dad's even thinking how 7 daughters could let this single man, a gentleman, go. I didn't just one of them grab him. Moses is found, he's invited back to the house. And Moses, who's the one who writes this down for us, he's a man of few words, and he says in verse 21, Moses agreed to stay with a man who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom. That's a lot of years in those few words. Now, at this crossroad of failure, I want us to see that God puts this opportunity for ministry right in front of Moses. If he was self-absorbed, he would have missed it. If he's licking all his wounds, even though he might have felt right now, you know what, I am done with the delivery business. It only leads to rejection. People don't appreciate it. No more for me. God puts these 7 women in front of him who need help. And we see the heart of God's rescuer, Moses, because God was preparing Moses to be his deliverer. But that wasn't to be realized right now. He would have to wait to deliver the Israelites out of their bondage in Egypt. But he could right now deliver these women from some unkind, abusive shepherds. See, God might not be calling Moses to rescue a nation at this time, but that doesn't mean he can't rescue these women from their plight. Now, you may be, you may not be, in the ministry that you had dreamed of, but you can jump in on a need that you see around us or within the church. You may not like the stage of life that you're in right now, but you can serve God faithfully at the well when that divine appointment shows up. I mean, you might be waiting for that big breakthrough to happen. You're just going to sit around and wait for it to happen. Listen, don't let that get in the way of seeing other opportunities to step in and help. Choose to do the next task in front of you. You're bummed right now about how your life's turning out? I get that. You might regret a decision you made, or you're just frustrated with the church, or you're fed up with people, or maybe you're just at this moment now, I am a complete failure. Now what? You stand at the crossroad of failure. Do what is available and ready for you to do. Do the next task. Don't sit and sulk. Step up and serve when an opportunity presents itself, because God was far from finished with Moses. But why take 40 years to work on them? Ever notice? God isn't in a hurry. We are. I am. I did this on my steering wheel a lot. Come on. It's green. You can turn now. And see, we want all the benefits of hard work without the hard work. There was a furniture store that had this sign on its window. It said, "Antiques while you wait." That's how we'd like it. I don't want to wait. Max Lucado said, "America is the country of shortcuts and fast lanes. We're the only nation on earth with a mountain called Rushmore." And that's why the temptation's there, folks, to help God out. It's taking way too long. We sang earlier, God will not delay. I go, he does delay sometimes. I'm going to help him out. Kierkegaard put it this way: Christians remind me of school kids who want to look up the answers to their math problems in the back of the book rather than work through them. What is God doing in Moses? He's developing a servant's heart. And you might be able to buy a fast pass at Disney or a flash pass at Six Flags, but listen, there is no fast pass to godly character, to true servanthood. Hang it up. There's no better way to cultivate a servant's heart than through some failure. It has a way of humbling us. The prince of Egypt is watering animals. The one who had grand dreams to deliver a nation has a chance to deliver a few helpless women. See, whatever season you're in, God wants to do something in your character. And it just might be through some failure, some mistake, where we're just ready to learn and we're ready to receive what God has for us. Stories told, perhaps you've heard it, of a new bank president who met with his predecessor. The young man said, I'd like to know what have been the keys to your success. The older gentleman looked at him and replied, "Young man, I can sum up the keys of my success in two words: good decisions." Well, to that, the young man responded, "I thank you immensely for that advice, but how does one come to know which are the good decisions?" "One word, young man," replied the sage, "experience." "Okay, that's all well and good," said the younger man, "but how does one get experience?" "Two words," said the elder, "bad decisions." Right? See, the crossroad of failure, we've made a bad decision. After blowing it, after our colossal mistake, we can learn from it. We can get up and do the task that's in front of us. God's not finished with us. Scene 5. Meanwhile, back in Egypt, Meanwhile, back in Egypt. The last three verses in this section have a meanwhile back in the ranch feel to it. While all this is happening with Moses and Midian, the Israelites back in Egypt are enduring 40 years of unspeakable suffering. I'm only going to hit these verses quickly. Perhaps we'll come back to them next week. But while Moses is climbing the character ladder in preparation of God's rescue operation, the people are living with real pain and suffering. They had nothing. No land of their own. No say in what was going on. They had no rights. They had no solution in sight. But these final three verses remind us that while God is working backstage, he himself takes center stage. Verse 23 tells us they groaned in their slavery. They cried out, and in their cry for help because of their slavery, went up to God. Now notice verse 24. God heard their groaning. He remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. You know, there are four beautiful verbs used here in these final verses that are somewhat lost in our translations. Because we could boil God's response to their cry for help down to this: God heard, God remembered, God saw, God knew. Literally, that's what it says. Heard, remembered, saw, knew. That's the God who's involved in your life and who hears your cry of help right now. He hears, he remembers his promises, he sees what's going on, and he knows you. And he knows the situation. See, not only did God have a plan for Moses, but on a much bigger scale, God had a plan for his people. But the people needed Moses to come back. And he will. We're going to see this. But he won't come back until God is done preparing his man for his rescue mission. Not until God's timing. Not until God's timing. Well, let me ask you again. Have you blown it? Have you made a mistake and you feel like a failure right now? You're at a crossroad. Will you humble yourself enough to learn from it? Can you trust God with that failure, that mistake? Remember the 70s chorus, through it all, I've learned to trust in Jesus. I've learned to trust in God. You see, through the mistakes and failures, through the Midian-like wilderness, through the lonely days beside the well, are you learning along the way to trust him? Because through it all, he is with us, he is teaching us, he is humbling us, he is preparing us. Because every one of us in this room, including myself, have failed, and I will fail again. But it's what we do with that failure that matters. Will it humble us? Will we learn from it? You see, because failure is God's classroom for character development. Failure is God's classroom for character development. Tom Watson Sr., who founded IBM, he guided Big Blue for over 40 years. One of his most impressive moments in leadership occurred when a junior executive lost an enormous amount of money for the company. This promising young man had been involved in a very risky venture for IBM, and he ended up losing over $10 million in the gamble. $10 million. Well, Tom Watson called this young man into his office, who just cost him $10 million. And the nervous junior executive blurted out, "Well, I guess you want my resignation." Watson replied, "Your resignation? You can't be serious. We've just spent $10 million educating you." You've blown it? God won't waste your failures. He wants to teach you and grow you. He wants to educate you in that moment. Do you stand at the crossroad of failure? What's your next move? Let's pray.